The original ending, the one where Andy ended up with Ducky instead of with Blaine. Artemis didn't respond. She just stared at the inscription, lost in thought. That rich, pretty boy Blaine, H said, glancing at the large, opulent homes lining both sides of the street. He must live around here, right? I say we find him and lock his ass in the trunk of his daddy's BMW. Then he won't be able to attend the prom tonight. When he doesn't show, Andy will have no choice but to spend the evening with Ducky. That would restore his ending, wouldn't it? That idea didn't sound half bad to me, but I waited for Artemis to answer. As fun as it sounds, I don't think that will do the trick, she said, pointing at the inscription on the shard. Recast the fowl, she repeated. Andy's fate. What about that scene in Ferris Bueller's Day Off, I asked. When he catches that foul ball during the Cubs game at Wrigley Field? Artemis seemed mildly impressed by my suggestion, at least enough to consider it for all of 2 seconds. Then she shook her head dismissively. I don't think so. Recast the foul. Recast the foul. Her eyes went wide, and her scowl of concentration transformed into a huge grin. I've got it, she cried. I know what we need to do. You do? H replied. Are you sure? She checked her swatch again, then turned to glance up and down the empty street. There's only one way to find out. We need to catch a ride over to the high school. The bus should be coming by any second now. Just as she finished saying this, a long yellow school bus rounded the corner at the end of the street. When it rolled to a stop at the curb in front of us, we could see the words Shermer High School stenciled across its side. The bus doors swung open, and Artemis jumped on board, then motioned for us to follow her. Another needle drop triggered, and the song Oh Yeah by Yellow kicked in as the four of us filed onto the bus. Artemis led us to a pair of empty seats near the middle. H sat next to her, and I sat beside Shoto. The seats around us were occupied by high school kid NPCs, all wearing 1980s clothing and hairstyles. Each one was modeled after a teenage actor from a school bus scene in one of John Hughes's films. I thought I spotted extras from 16 Candles and Ferris Bueller's Day Off. The bus began to move again, and I turned to glance out the window beside me. The sun was rising above the lake to the east, a beautiful spring morning in an upscale Midwestern suburb at the height of Reagan's America. Period-appropriate cars and trucks, 1989 or earlier, filled the tree-lined streets. Look at this lily-white hellscape, H said, shaking her head as she stared out her own window. Is there a single person of color in this entire town? Sure, Artemis replied. But most of them hang out at a place called the Candy Bar over in Chicago. This planet does have a serious diversity problem, like the whole of 80s cinema. H nodded. Well, maybe the next shard will be hidden in the kingdom of Zamunda. Oh, shit, Shoto replied. That would be dope. Just then, two freshman nerds in the seat directly in front of me and Shoto turned around to face us. At first, I thought they were wearing bras on their heads, but they were rocking athletic supporters as headbands instead. In unison, these two space cadets raised their toy laser pistols and fired them at us, and then one of them shouted, "Score! A direct hit!" before they both cracked up and turned back around. This place is a nut house, Shoto observed. I nodded, with some weird fashion trends. You ain't seen nothing yet, Artemis whispered. A second later, someone across the aisle loudly cleared their throat. We all turned to see a girl with obscenely thick eyeglasses staring at us. She slowly held her closed fist out to Shoto, then opened it to reveal a moist red gummy bear resting in the center of her palm. Want one? She asked. It's been in my pocket. They're real warm and soft. No, Shoto replied, shaking his head vigorously. No, thank you. I'll pass too, I said. Hey, look, H whispered, pointing to a red-headed girl seated near the front of the bus. I recognized her as Samantha Baker, Molly Ringwald's character in 16 Candles. Maybe one of us should go wish her a happy birthday, H said, chuckling softly. Every day is her birthday, Artemis said, and the morning after it. All the movie simulations on Shermer operate on an accelerated concurrent timeline, with the events depicted in each film repeating over and over in a continuous loop. All these NPCs are stuck in their own private Groundhog Day, including that poor sweetheart of a girl. She pointed to a tall girl who was sitting directly across the aisle from Sam. When she turned in profile, I saw that it was a young Joan Cusack. She was wearing an elaborate neck brace, probably to indicate that her character was an awkward dork, but even in traction, she still looked cute as hell. "She's my namesake, you know," Artemis said. I turned back and saw that she was nodding toward Samantha Baker. "I can't watch it without rage quitting now, but 16 Candles was one of my mom's favorite movies. She loved all of Hughes's films." "I remember," I said. "After she died, you would rewatch those movies to feel closer to her and to try and better understand who she was. I remember telling you that I did the same thing with my dad's comic book collection after he died." Artemis locked eyes with me, then she nodded. "I know," she said. "I remember that too." She smiled at me again, and this time I smiled back. We continued to grin at each other for a few more seconds. Then we remembered H and Shoto and turned to see them both watching us intently. "Caught," they both quickly averted their eyes. Just then, I got a glimpse of something strange out the bus windows behind them. We just crested a steep hill, and for a few seconds, the Chicago skyline was visible in the distance, beyond a sea of suburban trees bursting with bright orange and red fall colors. And I also caught a glimpse of the Hollywood Bowl. The giant amphitheater had been incongruously cut and pasted into Shermer's suburban landscape. H noticed it too and pointed it out to Artemis. "What the hell is that doing here?" she asked. "Doesn't the Hollywood Bowl belong in Hollywood?" "Indeed it does," Artemis replied. "But the Hollywood Bowl is where one of the date scenes in Some Kind of Wonderful takes place. It was one of the rare John Hughes teen films not set in the suburbs of Chicago. The designers decided to shoehorn it into the Shermer simulation anyway, along with Career Opportunities, which is set in Missouri." We all fell silent for a moment and gazed out the windows, taking in the strangely familiar sights that dotted the landscape around us. "We're getting close to the school," Artemis said. "Listen." The opening of the song Kajagoogoo, the instrumental version by the band of the same name, began to fade in on the Sim soundtrack. This needle drop had apparently been triggered by our proximity to the high school, which was now visible in the distance through the bus's front window. We were approaching the school from the south, so the building's exterior looked identical to the Shermer High School seen in the Breakfast Club. On my previous visit, I'd learned that when the school was viewed from the west, the building's facade matched the version of Shermer High School seen in 16 Candles, and the red brick facade on the north and east sides matched the school's appearance in Ferris Bueller's Day Off. But all three entrances led into the same building, which was filled with painstakingly detailed recreations of the various sets and practical locations used to create Shermer High's interior in the various cinematic incarnations of the school. Kajagoogoo continued to play, increasing in volume as our bus rolled up to the curb in front of the school, and Artemis, H, Shoto, and I filed off of it and attempted to blend in with the swell of NPC Shermer students surrounding us. We followed Artemis as she led us up the broad concrete sidewalk leading to the south entrance of the school. Hundreds of NPC teenagers sat in long rows on the stone benches that flanked either side of the walkway, all dressed in colorful mid-80s attire. As we made our way down this day-glow gauntlet, the kids all began to clap and stomp their sneaker-clad feet in time with the song, while chanting along with its only lyric, which spelled out its title, K-A-J-A-G-O-O-G-O-O. "Welcome to Shermer High School," Artemis said, stretching her arms out wide as she continued to walk backward toward the school building. "Shermer, Illinois, 60062. Artemis snapped her fingers and her avatar's attire changed once again. Now she wore Annie Potts' black latex outfit from her first scene in Pretty in Pink, along with her punk rock porcupine hairdo, dangling earrings, and dinner fork bracelet. "Applause, applause, applause," she said, doing a slow spin so that we could admire the attention to detail she'd put into her Iona cosplay. H, Shoto, and I all gave her an enthusiastic golf clap. She scowled at us, then reached into her inventory and pulled out a pair of retro sunglasses, the same pair of Risky Business Ray-Bans she'd been wearing when we first met. Then she produced three identical pairs from her inventory and tossed them to me, H, and Shoto. "For better hallway vision," she said. We all eyed her warily, then shook our heads. "Come on, you wimps," Artemis said. "Those are Hoffman lenses. You're going to need them." She motioned for us to put them on. When we complied, the The clothing on each of our avatars abruptly changed so that the three of us were dressed like the Dork Squad in 16 Candles. I was now the Geek, played by Anthony Michael Hall. H was John Cusack's character Bryce, and Shoto was their pal Cliff. H took a look at us and then glanced down at herself. She turned to glare at Artemis. "Not cool, Artie." Artemis laughed and then put on her own shades. As she did, her own avatar's outfit changed once again, this time into the threads that Ferris Bueller wore on his day off. Black and white leather jacket, leopard vest, the whole shebang. She gave her Ferris cosplay the finishing touch by pulling out a black beret and putting it on her head. Then she grinned at us and rubbed her hands together excitedly. "Okay, gang," she said. "This place is a lot more dangerous than it looks. Don't touch anything. Don't talk to anyone. Just follow my lead." We each removed our sunglasses and resumed our normal appearance. Then we followed Artemis up the steps that led to the front entrance. Once Artemis reached it, she threw open the front doors and another needle drop kicked in. 80s by Killing Joke. Hearing the song, she grinned and popped her collar as she led us inside. 0015. As Artemis led us through the hallowed halls of Shermer High School, we began to see a lot of strange things. Just inside the entrance, we passed a gaggle of jocks wearing identical blue and gray Letterman jackets featuring the school mascot, a bulldog. I recognized Andrew Clark, Emilio Estevez's character in The Breakfast Club, among them, along with Jake Ryan, Michael Scheffling's character from 16 Candles. They were both admiring a pep rally banner that read, "Go Bulldogs, go!" We also saw several posters urging students to attend the senior prom, which was scheduled for later tonight in the main ballroom at the Shermer Hotel. Every night of the week was prom night here on Shermer, all year long. "Hey, guys," Shoto called out, keeping his voice down to a loud whisper. "Over there. That's her, isn't it, Andy?" He pointed out a familiar-looking girl with red hair who was walking toward us. It was Molly Ringwald again, but not the one from 16 Candles we'd spotted earlier on the bus. This was a slightly older Molly with hair that was a much lighter shade of red. "Wrong Ringwald," Artemis said, shaking her head. "That's Claire Standish, the Molly from The Breakfast Club. We're looking for the Molly from Pretty in Pink. And at this time of the morning, she should be right over there." She pointed down the hall, where we saw yet another Molly Ringwald walking to class. This incarnation wore a pair of wire-rimmed spectacles, her bright red hair peeking out from beneath a black hat with a flower print scarf wrapped around it. She was dressed in a pink sweater over a pink blouse, and she did, in fact, look quite pretty in both of them. "I hate this place," H said, shaking her head as she took in our surroundings. "It's like being stuck in the Matrix with the Brat Pack." "That's why I love it," Artemis replied. "Don't yuck my yum, H. Don't do it." "Hold on," I said. "Andy Walsh didn't attend this school in Pretty in Pink, did she?" Artemis shook her head. "No," she replied. "She attended another fictional school, Meadowbrook High in Elgin, Illinois. But Pretty in Pink's characters and filming locations were amalgamated into Shermer, along with the rest of Hughes' filmography. Keeps you on your toes." We continued to follow Andy at a distance until she stopped to greet her friend Jenna, who was retrieving some textbooks from her locker. Shoto took a few tentative steps toward Andy, but Artemis grabbed him by the arm. "Not yet," she said. "We need to wait until she leads us to another NPC. Until he shows up, we have to keep our distance." I started to ask who she meant, but I was drowned out by an approaching male voice that was repeatedly shouting the phrase, "Save Ferris." We turned and saw that the voice belonged to a tall blonde boy making his way through the crowd. He was holding out an empty Pepsi can to passing students, many of whom were eagerly dropping money into it. "Thank you," he said, bowing slightly after each donation. "God bless you. Save Ferris?" The current of the crowd quickly carried him over to us, and he held his Pepsi can out to H before repeating his desperate plea. "Save Ferris?" H stared back at him stoically, then said, "Excuse me?" "Well, see, we're collecting money to buy Ferris Bueller a new kidney," the blonde guy explained. And those run about 50 G's or so. So if you could help out, H slapped the can out of his hands, sending it flying. Artemis hurried over and pulled H away, laughing, while the flustered blonde boy accused her of being a heartless wench. "Don't get distracted," Artemis said. "We need to keep track of Andy." She pointed up ahead of us. "I think she went that way. NPC behavior is somewhat randomized here. Andy usually visits her locker first, but sometimes she wanders into one of these classrooms and sits down instead. So keep moving and keep an eye out for her. We'll sweep the classrooms on both sides of the hall as we go." Artemis took off down the hall again, pushing and weaving through the oncoming torrent of NPC high school kids. H, Shoto, and I hurried after her. The school bell rang a few seconds later, and the hallway began to clear as NPC students filtered into their individual classrooms. One of them bumped into me as she went by, and when she turned to say, "Excuse me," I saw that it was a young Juliet Lewis, with her hair done up in a frizzy blonde 80s perm. I knew her best from her starring roles in Strange Days and From Dusk Till Dawn, so it took me a moment to remember that she'd portrayed Audrey Griswold in Christmas Vacation. Artemis was right. For someone who had trained themselves to identify pop culture icons from the 70s and 80s, this world was one huge distraction. As we continued to follow Artemis, she instructed us to split up and look inside each classroom we passed to see if we could locate Andy Walsh. I ran to the nearest door and glanced inside, then retreated as soon as I saw that it was an economics class being taught by Ben Stein, who was, of course, currently calling the roll. "Adams, Adam Lee, Adamowski, Adamson, Adler, Anderson," he said. "Anderson, here," I heard Anderson shout as I turned away and hurried on to the next classroom. It was the school's computer room, and it was currently filled with student NPCs typing out their term papers on rows of ancient desktop computers. A sign posted above the chalkboard said, "Hackers will be expelled." And that was one of the reasons I did a double take a few seconds later when I spotted the greatest fictional hacker of the 80s, Bryce Lynch, sitting at one of the computers. Then I noticed that Bryce looked older than I remembered, and he wasn't wearing his glasses. That finally made me realize that I was looking at Buck Ripley, a character in The Great Outdoors portrayed by Chris Young, the same actor who had played Bryce Lynch on Max Headroom a few years earlier. Even so, before I turned to leave, I silently saluted him, recalling the dark time during Halliday's contest when I'd used the name Bryce Lynch as my fake identity to avoid detection by IOI and the Sixers. A bit farther down the hall, I peeked into the open door of an art classroom. At first, I thought it was empty, but then I spotted Keith Nelson, Eric Stoltz's character from Some Kind of Wonderful, standing at an easel near the back of the room, painting a portrait of Leah Thompson, aka Miss Amanda Jones, with the song Brilliant Mind by Furniture playing out of a jam box on the desk beside him. I stood there transfixed for a moment after it occurred to me that I was watching the original Marty McFly paint a portrait of his mother. Then Artemis shouted for me to keep up, so I hurried to catch up with her. We passed by the open doors of the school gym, and inside we could see a bunch of girls in blue leotards doing various gymnastics exercises. On the wall, I noticed a large banner that said, "Go Mules, Go!" I pointed it out to Artemis. "I thought it was the Shermer Bulldogs," I said. "The football and wrestling teams are the Shermer Bulldogs," she said. "The basketball team is the Shermer Mules. See?" She pointed to a poster announcing an upcoming away game between the Shermer Mules and the Beacontown Beavers. Ahead of us, we found Shoto looking through another open doorway into some sort of shop class where dozens of male students were making identical ceramic elephant lamps. They lit up when the elephant's trunk was pulled. But one of the boys couldn't get his lamp to turn on, despite repeated attempts. When he turned around, we saw that it was Brian Johnson, Anthony Michael Hall's character in The Breakfast Club. H turned away to continue on to the next classroom, and I reluctantly followed her. Just before I lost sight of him, I saw Brian frown and cast a terrified glance toward his gruff-looking shop teacher. We rounded another corner, and Artemis suddenly threw her arms out as she skidded to an abrupt halt, causing the rest of us to collide with her and one another. Once we'd regained our balance, Artemis pointed up ahead. There was Andy Walsh, standing beside her open locker with an oddly dressed and extremely young John Cryer. "There he is," she said. "Philip F. Dale, better known as Ducky, a.k.a. the Duckman. One of the most divisive and controversial characters ever to spring forth from John Hughes's imagination." "Oh, that dude," H said, rolling her eyes. "What do we want from him? Fashion advice?" Artemis laughed and shook her head. "Just trust me, okay?" she replied. "I used to come to this place a lot. I've completed every single documented quest anchored here. A bunch of the older quests don't have any developer credits in their colophon, so no one knows who created them. But there were always rumors that some of these quests were created by Kira and Ogden Morrow, including several of the Pretty in Pink quests. I never took them seriously, but now I'm thinking those rumors may have been true." We watched as Andy closed her locker and began to walk down the hall, Ducky buzzing around her like an insect. I recited the clue printed on the second shard again in my head, trying to figure out why Artemis had brought us here. Then I groaned and rolled my eyes. "You've gotta be kidding me," I said. "The first line of the clue is a goddamn pun. Recast the foul, meaning a foul like a water foul?" "Correct," Artemis said, smiling at me. "More specifically, a duck." She nodded toward Ducky, then drew her curved elven sword from the scabbard on her back. Its blade sang like a giant tuning fork as she pulled it free. "Artie," H said, "what the hell are you doing?" "Wait for it," she said, gripping the hilt of her sword with both hands. She stood there waiting as another warning bell rang. Andy bid Ducky a hasty farewell and scurried away from him. Ducky raised his voice and continued to shout at her, asking if he should make lunch reservations for them in the cafeteria, perhaps at a table by the window. Andy covered her face in embarrassment, then turned and continued to walk in the other direction. "Listen, may I admire you again today?" he shouted as Andy disappeared into one of the classrooms down the hall. "Poor Ducky," Shoto whispered as we watched all of this go down. "Poor Ducky?" Artemis repeated, aghast. "Don't you mean poor Andy?" She takes pity on the guy because she knows he's struggling with his own sexual identity and that he doesn't have any other friends. And how does Ducky repay her sympathy and kindness? By ignoring her boundaries, hounding her 24/7, and humiliating her in public every chance he gets. And check out how he treats other women when Andy isn't around. She turned and motioned back over at Ducky, who had just walked over to a pair of preppy-looking girls standing a few yards away from us. "Ladies, ladies," we heard him say. "Listen, I may be able to work out a deal where either one or the both of you could be pregnant by the holidays. What do you—" Before the duck man was able to finish his sentence, Artemis ran over to him and swung her sword, lopping his head completely off at the neck. "There can be only one," she shouted as Ducky's head went flying, taking his blow-dried pompadour along with it. It bounced off a nearby locker with a loud metal clang before coming to rest on the waxed marble floor of the hallway, not far from his now decapitated body. The preppy girls he'd been addressing a split second earlier screamed and scattered, along with the other student NPCs who had been lingering in the vicinity. "Jesus Christ, Artie!" H shouted. "You could have warned us first." "Yeah," Shoto added, chuckling to himself. "Next time, give us a heads up." H cut his laughter short by shoving his avatar into a wall. I watched as Ducky's head and body faded away, leaving behind the loot he'd been carrying. A few gold coins, his vintage thrift store clothing, a bolo tie, and a pair of battered white wing-tipped shoes with buckles instead of laces. Artemis scooped up the shoes and the tie, but didn't bother with the clothes or the coins. "Annoying dipshit," she said, as she wiped Ducky's blood off her blade and slid it back into its scabbard. "I never liked him, or the generations of spineless toolbags who have rooted for Andy to end up with him." "Hold the phone," Shoto said. "Are you telling me you're on Team Blaine?" "Of course not," Artemis replied, looking mildly revolted. "Blaine is even worse than Ducky. I never thought either one of them was a good match for Andy, and Kira Morrow held the same opinion." "Okay," Shoto said slowly. but I still don't understand why you decapitated Ducky. To recast the foul, she said, and restore his ending. How are we supposed to restore the ending where Andy winds up with Ducky when you just killed Ducky? I asked. I'll show you, she said, but we need to make one more stop first. She took off running again, and since we really had no choice, H, Shoto, and I followed. After several more identical-looking hallways, Artemis finally slid to a halt in front of a long row of orange lockers. One of these lockers had a warning scrawled across its door in black magic marker. Touch this locker and you die, fag. Hey, I shouted, Bender's locker! H nodded and folded her arms. I always questioned his reasoning here, she said. Don't you think this homophobic graffiti would encourage people to mess with his locker rather than discourage them? Bender didn't think things through. Yeah, Artemis replied. Lucky for us. She turned and grabbed a fire axe off the wall. She used it to smash open Bender's combination lock, then gingerly opened the locker door and quickly yanked her hand clear. When the door popped open, a small guillotine slid down the length of its frame, chopping off the toe of a sneaker that was poking out of the bottom of the locker. Artemis dug through the locker's bizarre contents until she finally found a crumpled brown paper bag. She opened it and pulled out another, even smaller paper bag, stained with what appeared to be French fry grease. From inside that bag, she then withdrew a clear plastic sandwich bag filled with a copious amount of marijuana. Artie held up the bag of weed in her left hand and Ducky's shoes in her right. We've got the magic herb and the magic slippers, Artemis said. Now it's time for us to hit the city, baby. Dead on. We have some drinks, a little nightlife, some dancing. Let's go. She took off running again. We ran after her. Once we made it back outside, Artemis took us on a shortcut across the football field, and as we walked past one of the goalposts, we triggered another needle drop on the simulation soundtrack. It happened to be one of H's all-time least favorite songs, Don't You Forget About Me by Simple Minds. She already looked as if her nerves were hanging by a thread, and this nearly pushed her over the edge. Oh, give me a fucking break, she cried, shouting to be heard over the opening of the song. Seriously? Do all of us need to be here for this shit right now? I gave her a playful shove forward and we ran to catch up with Artemis and Shoto. As we did, the song continued to play, and when it reached its crescendo, H mockingly raised her right fist to the sky. It made the rest of us crack up. A few seconds later, H's smile vanished. I'm getting a call, she said. It's Indira. I promised to check in. I gotta take this. Give me one second. H walked several yards away and turned her back to us before she answered the call. I caught a glimpse of the worried face of her fiancé, Indira, in a vidfeed window in front of her. She was calling from their home in L.A., where she was still holding a vigil beside H's sabotaged immersion vault. H muted their conversation so we couldn't hear what they were saying, but we didn't need to. It was obvious that Indira was distraught. And H was trying to calm her down. Shoto sighed. I know we don't have time for this, but I've been dying to talk to Kiki too. Artemis looked thoughtful for a moment. Then she turned to me. It won't take all four of us to collect this shard, she said. How about you and I keep moving and give H and Shoto a few minutes with their ladies? We can call them once we have it. The prospect of being alone with Artemis for the first time in years rendered me momentarily speechless. After a few seconds of awkward silence, I finally blurted out a response. Sure, I said, as nonchalantly as I could. That's a great idea, and very thoughtful of you. Artemis nodded to Shoto, then tilted her head at me and gave me an odd grin. Okay, Z, let's go snag this thing. Then she was gone, running down the street again. I sprinted to catch up with her. Then I continued to follow her for several blocks into a section of the simulation where it was always night, and the season appeared to be set to sometime in the spring or early summer. We were still on the rich side of town, in another upscale neighborhood near the lakeshore, on a street lined with large expensive homes, and there appeared to be a wild party going on in every single one of them. Parents are in Europe, Artemis said, pointing at one house, then another, and another. Parents are in Europe, parents are in Europe. All of the rich kids' parents are in Europe. The first house we passed on our left was one I recognized from Some Kind of Wonderful. It belonged to Craig Sheffer's character, Hardy Jens. I could see him inside through one of the big picture windows, plotting with his yuppie pals. A few seconds after we walked past his house, a black and gray limousine pulled up out front and Mary Stuart Masterson got out. She opened the door for Eric Stoltz, and then he opened Leah Thompson's door. Eric and Leah went into Hardy's house, and Mary Stuart stayed behind and leaned against the limo's bumper. A few seconds later, a black cargo van pulled into Hardy's driveway, and a skinhead named Duncan, Elias Cotillas, jumped out, along with a whole gang of mean-looking hoods, and they all ran into Hardy's house, too. We could hear the song Beat So Lonely by Charlie Sexton blasting from within. That party is about to become a historical fact, Artemis said. That made me laugh out loud, which somehow earned me another one of her smiles. We continued down the street. The neighboring house belonged to Steph McKee, James Spader's character in Pretty in Pink. He was greeting guests at his front door. For a split second, I mistook the NPC for the male form of Lohengrin's avatar, which looked nearly identical but had shorter hair. A few minutes later, we reached the Donnelly residence, where the events depicted in Weird Science were transpiring in and around the house. A few seconds after we arrived, a half-naked girl shot up out of the chimney and landed in a small pond in the front yard with a loud splash. Here we go, Artemis said. We're looking for two NPCs from Weird Science. Hang here for a minute, I'll be right back. She drew her guns and ran inside the house. I heard a rapid volley of gunfire, followed by what sounded like a grenade going off. A few seconds later, Artemis rejoined me on the sidewalk in front of the house. They're not in there, she said. Sometimes Max and Ian leave to party hop when things get too crazy at the Donnelly residence. Sometimes they stick around and get turned into farm animals. But that usually doesn't happen until after midnight. Max and Ian? I said. The two assholes who dump an icy on Gary and Wyatt in Weird Science? Why the hell do we need them? So that we can get the third shard, Z, she replied in the tone of someone explaining something obvious to a very small child. Just trust me, okay? That'll save us a lot of time. She pointed behind her. We need to look for them at the parties being held on that side of the street now. I'll go see if they're at Stubby's. You go check out the shindig next door. She pointed to another huge house across the street. Long strands of toilet paper were hanging from all of the trees out front. Beer cans, pizza boxes, and horny teenagers were strewn across the lawn. Music was blaring from within. Who lives there? I asked. Jake Ryan, she said. If you spot Ian or Max, I need you to restrain both of them and then call me. If I spot them at Stubby's, I'll do the same. Okie dokie, oggie doggie? I grinned and replied, okie dokie, doggy daddy. Artemis took off, sprinting toward Stubby's house. I stared after her uncertainly for a moment. Then I took a deep breath and ran in the opposite direction, toward Jake Ryan's house. 0016. The front yard looked like a war zone. Teenagers were milling around in the yard and the street, leaning on vintage Porsches, Ferraris, and Trans Ams, dancing, drinking, and making out. Parked in the middle of the driveway, there was a red BMW with a drive-in food tray hanging from its passenger window. A mud-covered blue sedan was parked on top of a Beamer, and two teenagers were making out in its back seat. I walked up to the front door and pressed the doorbell. A loud gong sounded as it swung inward. A young Asian man was hanging from the inside of the door. He was extremely intoxicated. It took me a second to realize I knew him. It was Long Duck Dong, Getty Watanabe's infamous character from 16 Candles. "What's a happenin', hot stuff?" he said, speaking with a thick accent. When I failed to answer, the donger motioned for me to come on inside. I thanked him and continued on into the house. It was packed with rich, drunk white kids in full-on party mode. I bumped into a young Joan Cusack, dressed as the girl in the neck brace we'd seen earlier on the bus. She was trying to drink a beer by leaning her whole body backward, but then she leaned too far and fell on the floor. Then I went to do a sweep of the living room, but was nearly crushed by a set of exercise weights that came crashing down through the ceiling. They continued to crash on through the floor, opening up an enormous hole into the wine cellar and smashing dozens of the bottles stored there. I continued to make a complete circuit of the house, but didn't see Ian or Max anywhere. I had just made my way back to the living room when I received a text from Artemis on my HUD telling me to meet her at Stubby's house next door in the backyard. I sprinted outside and across the perfectly manicured lawn to the rear of the adjacent house, which was also in the process of being trashed by reckless drunken teenagers. In Stubby's backyard, I found Artemis holding two extremely handsome teenaged boys at gunpoint, Ian and Max from Weird Science. Max was played by the actor Robert Russler, whom I also knew from his role as Ron Grady in A Nightmare on Elm Street 2, Freddy's Revenge. And Ian was played by an impossibly young Robert Downey Jr. "Holy shit," I said, "the OG Iron Man. I forgot he was in a John Hughes movie." "Just one," Artemis said. "A supporting role in Weird Science. But, little known fact, Robert Downey Jr. almost played the lead in another Hughes film. That's why we need him." Artemis pointed at Max. "Him, we can let go," she said. She lowered her assault rifle so that it was no longer pointed at Max's head. Max stood there, frozen for a second. Then he turned tail and took off running across the expansive green lawn in the direction of Jake Ryan's house. He never looked back. Artemis turned her attention back to Ian. She removed the bag of weed she'd taken from Bender's locker and dangled it in front of him. The expression on his face suddenly went blank, as if he'd been hypnotized. "Would you like some of this?" Artemis asked. "Why, yes, madam," Ian replied. "I certainly would." He reached for the bag, but she yanked it back out of his reach. "I'll make you a deal," Artemis said. "I'll give you this whole bag of doobage if you just perform two simple tasks for me." "Sure," Ian said, batting his eyelashes at her. "Anything you say, doll." "I figured out this little trick by playing through all the official Weird Science quests," Artemis said. "The NPC recreations of Max and Ian are both total hedonists, and they'll perform nearly any task in exchange for sex or drugs." She turned to smile at him. "Isn't that right, Ian?" RDJ batted his eyelashes at her again and nodded. Artemis opened her inventory and took out the wingtip shoes and bolo tie she'd looted from Ducky back at the high school, then held them out to Ian. "First, I need you to put these on," she said. "Then I need you to go dance with Andy Walsh at the senior prom tonight. Deal?"
"Deal,"
Ian said. He took the shoes from her and put them on. Then he put the bolo tie around his neck. As soon as he did, his wardrobe and hairstyle changed. He no longer looked like Robert Downey Jr. as Ian in Weird Science. Now he looked like Robert Downey Jr. in Back to School, in the role of Derek Lutz. But he was dressed in the same vintage suit that John Cryer wore in the original ending of Pretty in Pink. When his transformation completed, it triggered another music cue. At first, I thought I was hearing the song I Want a New Drug by Huey Lewis and the News, but as soon as the lyrics kicked in, I realized it was actually Weird Al Yankovic's parody, I Want a New Duck. The song only played for 5 or 6 seconds, while the newly anointed Robert Ducky Jr. did a little dance to show off his new attire. Then the song cut out, and he struck a pose and said, "I remain now, and will always be, a Duckman." He pointed down at his shoes, turned his left foot left, then his right foot right, before realigning them both. Then he looked back up at us. When we failed to applaud, he frowned and sniffed each of his armpits before asking, "Do I offend?" Artemis let out a victorious cry, then ran over and slapped him on the back. "Robert Downey Jr. was originally supposed to play the role of Ducky," she explained, "but the studio decided to cast John Cryer in the role instead, and when the first cut of the film was screened, no one in the test audience wanted Ducky and Andy to end up together. So on short notice, Hughes was forced to write a new ending, one in which Andy ends up with that rich douchebag Blaine instead." "Really?" I said. "I never knew that." I shook my head. "Pretty impressive, Artie." "Why, thank you, Parzival," she replied, sounding genuinely pleased with herself. I remembered reading an old interview with Molly Ringwald, where she said she believed Hughes' original ending of Pretty in Pink would have worked if Robert Downey Jr. had played the role of Ducky as originally intended, because the two of them would have had a lot more on-screen chemistry. I recited the inscription again, this time from memory. "Recast the foul, restore his ending. Andy's first fate still needs mending." So that was Andy's first fate, I said, to wind up with RDJ as Ducky? And the only way to mend that fate is to recast the foul? I smiled at Artemis and shook my head. "Artie, you're a genius." I gave her a round of applause and she took a small bow. Then she grabbed Robert Ducky Jr. by the arm and took off running again. I ran after them as they sprinted across Stubby's lawn and then over to a Rolls-Royce convertible that was parked in Jake Ryan's driveway. Artemis shoved Ducky into the back seat and then got behind the wheel. I jumped into the passenger seat beside her. "Hey," I said, "wouldn't we get there faster in a Ferrari?" I pointed to the woods behind Jake Ryan's house. There, visible through the trees, was a secluded house on stilts. I recognized it as Cameron Fry's residence, and from here we could see the separate glass-walled garage at the back of the house. "Forget it," Artemis said. "Cameron's dad has a state-of-the-art security system. You can only steal that car in the daytime, with the keys and with Cameron's help. If you try to steal it now, you'll end up in the Shermer jail with the kid from Reach the Rock. It's easy enough to escape, but we'd waste 30 minutes. She smiled. "We could steal the same Ferrari from Alec Baldwin in a church parking lot just a few blocks from here," she said, pointing off to the south. Then she glanced at her watch. "But the Briggs-Bainbridge wedding doesn't start for another hour? Sorry, but I'm afraid Mr. Ryan's Rolls-Royce is our best option at the moment." "Fine," I muttered. "We'll take this brown shitbox." "Buckle up, Ace," Artemis said, glancing over at me. She waited for me to comply. Once I did, she gave me a devious smile. "This is getting good," she said, as she shifted the car into drive and floored the gas. This triggered another needle drop, the Peter Gunn theme, which continued to play as the Rolls-Royce peeled out, carrying us off into the night. As Artemis drove through the moonlit labyrinth of suburban streets at breakneck speed, Robert Downey Jr. and I were jerked around in our seats again and again as she whipped the Rolls around sharp corners. For a few minutes, I felt like we'd been transported into a game of Grand Theft Auto Shermer until Artemis turned onto the highway and our ride smoothed out. Taking the on-ramp triggered a fresh needle drop, Holiday Road by Lindsey Buckingham, which cut back out when we got off the highway a few exits later. At some point, we must have crossed over the railroad tracks and entered the poor side of town, because the houses around us became smaller, crappier, and closer together. As we were driving down one of these streets, I spotted Harry Dean Stanton, dressed in a bathrobe, sitting on a lawn chair in his darkened front yard, reading a newspaper. A few houses down, I saw John Bender standing in an open garage, smoking a cigarette while he stirred a can of paint. Then I noticed the house right next door, which looked completely abandoned. The lawn was overgrown, the windows were all boarded up, and a foreclosed sign was nailed to the front door. Then I noticed the name printed on the rusted mailbox out front, D. Griffith. I pointed it out to Artemis and she smiled. "There are five different John Candy NPCs wandering around Shermer," she said. "Can you name all of them?" "Sure," I said. "Del Griffith, of course. Then there's Chet Ripley, C.D. Marsh, and Gus Polinski, the Polka King of the Midwest. Oh, and I saw Buck Russell this morning." She grinned at me, impressed. "Not bad, Watts," she said. "Still sharp as a tack." She pointed to a log cabin-style restaurant on the other side of the street called Paul Bunyan's Cupboard, with large statues of Paul and Babe the Blue Ox by its front entrance. "Want to stop in and try to eat an old 96er?" Artemis asked. "It's probably a lot harder when you're using an ONI. Appearing to realize what she'd just said, she cut herself off, and out of the corner of my eye, I saw her wince. "Fuck yes," I said, elbowing her in the ribs to let her know it was all right. "If we had time, I would destroy an old 96er right now," I lowered my voice. You might think I'd be opposed to eating something with the word sixer in its name, but I am not. At all. Artemis laughed her laugh again, and it was music to my ears. "When this is over, we're coming back here to chow down, okay?" I said. She nodded and said, "It's a date." I felt myself turn several different shades of red. As we continued to drive, I stole a glance over at her in the driver's seat. The top was down and the wind was in her hair. She looked beautiful and happy, and I was still madly in love with her, no matter how much I denied it. Out of nowhere, another needle drop triggered, and a new song began to play, "More Than a Feeling" by Boston. The same song plays during a brief flashback in She's Having a Baby when Jake falls in love with his future wife, Christy, at first sight. As soon as it began, Artemis snapped her head to the right and caught me staring at her. I glanced away, pretending to look out the windshield. But in the reflection in the glass, I thought I caught a glimpse of her smiling. Then I heard her laugh. "What's so funny?" I asked. "That song," she replied. It starts to play whenever one avatar stares at another avatar for longer than 5 seconds while also experiencing a drastic increase in their heart rate. It's a little Easter egg they added for ONI users last year. "Great," I muttered, busted by my own biomonitors. She laughed, keeping her eyes on the road ahead. I sank down into my seat and pretended to look out the window, wishing that magic worked on this planet so that I could turn myself invisible. We arrived at the Shermer Hotel a few minutes later. Artemis screeched Mr. Ryan's Rolls-Royce up onto the curb, causing several NPC pedestrians to dive out of the way. The three of us jumped out of the car and sprinted toward the hotel's main entrance, but RDJ skidded to a halt just shy of the threshold. "I'm sorry," he said to Artemis, "but I can't go in there." "What?" she replied, grabbing him by his satin lapels. "Why the hell not? You promised, and I already gave you all of Bender's weed." "I know," RDJ replied, "and I want to help you out, but I can't go in there. Not like this. I wouldn't know what to do or say." "You don't have to say anything," Artemis said, prodding him toward the entrance. "Just go in there, find the hot redhead in the atrocious pink nightgown, and ask her to dance. That's it. Done." The RDJ NPC shook his head and didn't budge. Artemis nodded at me, and I grabbed him around the waist, lifted him off the ground, and attempted to carry him across the threshold. But I couldn't do it. It was like he kept bouncing off an invisible force field that somehow prevented him from going inside. I tried a few more times anyway, to no avail. Then RDJ began to struggle, trying to get free of my grip. "I'm sorry," he cried, "but I'm just not emotionally prepared at this exact juncture to go in there. I mean, look how I'm dressed, and I never know what to say at formal social gatherings such as this." Artemis gave me a nod, and I let go of him. He straightened his suit and gave me an indignant glare. I thought he might bolt, but instead he folded his arms and began to absentmindedly tap his foot, an indication that he was running an idle animation. I turned to Artemis. "Recast the foul. Restore his ending," I recited. "This whole time we thought the clue meant we were supposed to restore Ducky's ending. But what if restore his ending means we need to restore John Hughes's ending? The ending of Pretty in Pink he originally wrote in his screenplay." I nodded at the RDJ NPC. "What if we need to find a copy of the original script and give it to him?" Artemis threw up her hands. "And how are we supposed to do that?" I smiled at her. "We go to the writer's house," I replied. She gave me a puzzled look for a few seconds, then her eyes lit up with understanding. "Holy shit," she cried. "That might be it. Z, you're a genius." Before I knew what the hell was happening, she grabbed my face and planted a kiss on me. She wasn't wearing an ONI headset, so I knew she didn't feel that kiss, but I did. Then she turned to RDJ. "Don't go anywhere," she told him. "We'll be right back." Then she grabbed me by the arm and pulled me back in the direction of the car. 0017. Artemis knew a shortcut through the rich side of town and was somehow able to navigate from memory, racing through the dark, undifferentiated maze of identical streets, each lined with identical houses. She managed to get us there in just a few minutes, but her erratic driving triggered another needle drop, March of the Swivel Heads by the English Beat. I don't think she touched the brake pedal once until we finally screeched to a halt in the Johnson family's driveway. As soon as our feet touched the driveway, another needle drop went off, Modigliani, Lost in Your Eyes by Book of Love. Hearing it, Artemis glanced over at me, and we shared a brief smile of recognition. Then we both turned and ran to the front door. She rang the doorbell, and a second later, Mrs. Johnson opened it, wearing an annoyed scowl. Her young daughter was standing in the doorway behind her, and she was scowling at us, too. I recognized both of them from their brief scene in The Breakfast Club when they drop Anthony Michael Hall's character, Brian, off at detention, and his mom says, "Well, mister, you better figure out a way to study." And then his little sister says, "Yeah." Another piece of trivia I'd learned from Artie's blog years ago was that they were played by Anthony Michael Hall's real-life mother and sister. "I'm sorry," Mrs. Johnson said after she spent a few more seconds scowling at us. "We don't allow solicitors." She pointed to a small no solicitors sign with gold lettering nailed to their front door. "Oh, we're not selling anything, Mrs. Johnson," Artemis said. My name is Artemis, and this is my friend Parzival. We're here to speak with your husband about our mutual friend Ducky, Philip F. Dale. Mrs. Johnson's scowl vanished, and she gave Artemis a huge smile. In the next moment, her face melted and morphed, and she transformed into a completely different woman. Now, the NPC in front of us was a slender woman with long blonde hair and a warm, friendly smile. I didn't recognize her at all, but Artemis did, instantly. Mrs. Hughes, she said, lowering her eyes and bowing her head as if she'd just encountered royalty. Then she glanced sideways at me and whispered, Nancy Hughes, I've never seen her here before. I didn't even know you could. John is upstairs working, Nancy said, stepping back to open the door the rest of the way for us, but I believe he's expecting you. Please, come on in. She ushered us into the foyer and closed the front door. I looked around for Brian Johnson's little sister, but she'd vanished along with her mother. However, I did catch a glimpse of two young boys chasing each other around the dining room table with Nerf guns. I realized they must be NPC recreations of the Hughes' two sons, James and John. Seeing them reminded me of an interview John Hughes gave where he mentioned that his screenplay for Mr. Mom was based on his experience caring for his two boys on his own for a year when his wife Nancy spent a lot of time traveling for work. Hughes's children and marriage had directly inspired so much of his work. It seemed fitting that this interactive tribute to his family was hidden here on Shermer, among all of his fictional creations. Artemis and I continued to gaze around us in wonder, like museum patrons on their first visit, until Nancy politely cleared her throat to get our attention. Then she pointed to the long, curved wooden staircase behind her. He's upstairs in his office at the end of the hall, she said, lowering her voice to a whisper. But make sure to knock before you go in. He's writing. Thank you, ma'am, I whispered back. I motioned for Artemis to lead the way and followed her up the stairs. When we reached the top, we could hear a typewriter clacking down the hall. Treading as softly as we could on the wooden floorboards, we followed the sound to a closed door at the end of the hall. The thick aroma of tobacco wafted in the air, rising from the crack at the bottom of the door, along with the sound of music, Dream Academy's instrumental version of the Smiths' Please, Please, Please Let Me Get What I Want. I gave Artemis a nod, then I took a deep breath and rapped three times on the door. The clacking of typewriter keys ceased and we heard someone get up, followed by approaching footsteps. Then the door opened, and there he was, standing right in front of us in the simulated flesh, John Wilden Hughes, Jr. He looked different from how he'd looked when I'd caught a glimpse of him a few hours earlier as he was collecting his morning paper with the other middle-aged men of Shermer. His hair was longer and spikier, his glasses were bigger and rounder and had different frames. He had the same rounded features and the same sad, wise eyes, but he no longer wore the stern and passive expression he'd had back when he was Mr. Johnson. Now that he was Mr. Hughes, he was full of energy and emotion, along with epic amounts of nicotine and caffeine, judging by all of the empty coffee cups on his desk and the overflowing ashtray beside his enormous green IBM Selectric typewriter. Behind his desk, carefully displayed on some shelves, were dozens of pairs of shoes, his famous sneaker collection, which continued to grow throughout his life. Artemis! He bellowed in an extremely deep voice, smiling wide in recognition as soon as he saw her. I've been expecting you! Then, to our shock, he went in for a hug. Artemis laughed and hugged John Hughes back while giving me a can-you-believe-this-is-happening look over his shoulder. Then he let go of her and turned to me. And you brought a friend along, he said, offering me his hand. Hi there, I'm John. Parzival, I replied, shaking it. The guy had a firm grip. It's an honor to meet you, sir. I'm a big fan of your work. Really? He said, placing his right hand over his heart. That's so wonderful to hear and kind of you to say. Please, won't you both come on in? After we stepped into his office, he closed the door, then hurried over to a row of filing cabinets in the corner and began to dig through its drawers. You're here for a copy of my Pretty in Pink script, right? He asked. Which draft did you want? Your favorite draft, Artemis said. The one with your original ending where Ducky and Andy dance together? He gave her a big smile, then resumed digging through his filing cabinet drawers. That was my favorite ending, he said. But it didn't work for the test audience, so the studio made me change it. He finally found the script he was looking for and shouted, Victory! As he held it over his head. A golden shaft of light descended from the ceiling for a few seconds, bathing him and the script in its glow as we heard the sound of angelic chimes. Then he held the script out and presented it to Artemis. She took it from him with both hands, and as she did, the light vanished and the chimes ceased. "Thank you," Artemis said, bowing slightly. "Very much." "My pleasure," he said. "If you need anything else, you know where to find me." He gave us both another handshake. Then he sat back down at his desk and immediately began typing again, faster than I'd ever seen anyone type in my life. The clack of his keys sounded like machine gun fire, and the carriage return moved rapidly from left to right in just a few seconds, like an ammo belt feeding it a steady supply of bullets. Artemis turned toward me, wearing a big goofy grin, and held up the script so that I could see what was typed on its cover page. "Pretty in Pink" by John Hughes. Fifth draft, 5/9/85. "We got it," she said. I nodded and offered her a high five. She laughed and slapped my hand. "Let's go get that shard," I said. She nodded, and we turned around to leave. But when I reached for the doorknob, I discovered something odd. A black computer keyboard was hanging on the back of Hughes's office door, dangling from the coat hook by its cord. "Weird," I said, grabbing the keyboard to examine it more closely. That was when we both saw the brand name and model number. It wasn't just a keyboard. It was a Memotech MTX-512, the vintage computer that Gary and Wyatt used to create Lisa in Weird Science, which had, in revolutionary at the time fashion, hidden its 8-bit CPU in the chassis of the keyboard itself. It looked pretty beat up. A few of the keys on the keyboard were missing. I turned to address the John Hughes NPC. "What's this doing here?" I asked. But Hughes didn't even seem to hear me. He just kept on writing. I turned back to Artemis and handed the computer to her. "When I ran into Wyatt's house earlier, I noticed that his computer was missing from his bedroom," she said. "The FDX hard drive add-on was still there, but this keyboard was gone, which would appear to indicate that someone took it from Wyatt's and brought it here." I leaned forward to study the keyboard more closely. There were four missing letters. The R, A, I, and K keys were gone. Then it hit me. "Ogg," I said. "He was here earlier today when he collected the third shard, and he put the computer here where he knew we would see it." I pointed at the Memotech MTX-512. "In Weird Science, a nerd used this computer to create a simulation of his dream girl," I said. "Maybe Ogg is trying to tell us that Halliday did the same thing. That's why he knocked out these four keys, K, I, R, and A." "Holy shit," Artemis said. "Kira!" I nodded. Then another light bulb went on over my head. If Ogg was able to leave behind a hidden message for us here, maybe he did the same thing when he was collecting the first two shards, I said. I should have realized it on Kodama. I explained to Artemis how Ogg's strange high score on the Ninja Princess video game had puzzled me. "Did you spot anything else on Kodama?" Artemis asked. "Anything else out of place?" I thought it over for a moment, then shook my head. "I don't think so," I said. "I don't remember seeing anything like that on Middletown either, but there are 256 different instances of Middletown spread across the planet, and Ogg could have obtained his shard from any one of them." "That's hopeless," Artemis said, shaking her head. "We don't have time to search all those instances. We still have four more shards to collect and only about 5 hours to do it." "You're right," I said. "We don't have time. But I bet I know someone who does. Hold on, give me a minute." I pulled up my HUD and selected Lohengrin's name from my contact list. Then I tapped the icon to send her a text. Then, on the off chance that Anorak was monitoring my video feeds, I closed my eyes and typed out my entire message to Lo without looking at it. "Dear Lo, I could use some more of your help after all. I need you to go back and locate the instance of Middletown where Ogg obtained the first shard. It should be the only other instance on the planet that is currently set to the year 1989. You'll have to teleport around and check them all, one at a time, until you find it. Once you do, I need you to look for anything unusual or out of place, something around Ogg's home or in Kira's bedroom. If you find something, message me immediately and I'll send you my coordinates so we can meet in a secure location. Thanks, Lo. I can't tell you anything more right now, but I promise it's important. I owe you a Wookiee life debt for this. Sincerely, Z. I used a keyboard shortcut to send the message without looking at it. Then I opened my eyes, closed my HUD, and turned back to face Artemis. I emailed a friend who might be able to help, I said. Fingers crossed. Artemis gave me a dubious look and folded her arms. A friend? She repeated. What friend? Was that a hint of jealousy in her voice? I'll tell you later, I said, as I threw open the door of Hughes's office and sprinted off down the hall. Come on! As we headed down the stairs, I cast a glance back down the hall. Through his open office door, I caught one last, brief glimpse of John Hughes, sitting at his desk, hunched over his typewriter in a thick cloud of cigarette smoke, clacking away furiously on his typewriter keys, writing as if his life depended on it. Artemis drove us back to the Shermer Hotel, where the NPC of Robert Ducky Jr. was standing frozen out front. She handed him the script we'd retrieved from John Hughes. RDJ opened it to the last few pages and scanned them in a matter of seconds. Then, as soon as he finished reading them, the script suddenly vanished in a shower of glittering gold dust. Got it, Ducky said as he put on his sunglasses. Let's plow. Then, he ran inside the hotel. We followed him through the hotel lobby and down a long, marble-floored mezzanine, which led into the main ballroom where the senior prom was being held. Andy Walsh was waiting there, standing all alone in her homemade pink dress, biting her lower lip and looking around nervously. When she spotted Robert Downey Jr. walking toward her, decked out in his Ducky threads, her eyes widened in surprise, just as some piano music from Michael Gore's Pretty in Pink score swelled on the soundtrack. Then, without hesitation, Andy ran toward Ducky. He started running too, and when they reached each other, she leaped into his open arms. Then he twirled her around a few times before setting her back down. They both took a step back to admire each other's outfits, exchanging a few words that we were too far away to make out. Then Andy took Ducky's arm, and together they walked through the ballroom entrance. Artemis and I followed them inside. It looked identical to the ballroom where the original ending of Pretty in Pink was filmed. There was a large dance floor in the center of the room where a few hundred well-to-do Shermer teenagers, dressed in retro tuxedos and pastel-colored prom dresses, were grooving to the song If You Leave by Orchestral Maneuvers in the Dark. Two DJs in matching bellhop outfits stood on the stage, surrounded by synthesizers and mixing boards. A giant black-and-white photograph of a conductor and his orchestra covered the wall behind them. Circular dining tables were arranged on either side of the dance floor, and I spotted Steph McKee again, sitting at one of them in a tuxedo, looking bored. Then he saw who had just walked into the room and sat bolt upright. As Andy and Ducky slowly made their way to the dance floor, every pair of eyes in the room turned to look at them. When the couples out on the floor spotted them, they too stopped dancing to stare. A few seconds after that, the DJs stopped the music too. Now, everyone in the room was motionless, staring at Andy and Ducky with bourgeois contempt burning in their eyes. We watched from a distance as Blaine McDonough emerged from the silent crowd and walked over to Andy and Ducky. He said something to Andy, but she only responded by shaking her head. Blaine offered his hand to Ducky, and after considering it for a few seconds, Ducky shook it. Blaine turned and walked away, disappearing back into the crowd. Boom! Artemis shouted. Andy's first fate no longer needs mending! We continued to watch as Andy took Ducky's hand and the two of them walked through the sea of silent staring faces, wearing proud and defiant looks of their own. When they reached the center of the dance floor, the DJs turned the sound system back on and queued up a new song, Heroes by David Bowie. Ducky took Andy in his arms and the two of them began to dance, spinning around and around together until they merged into a single whirling blur of pink. Then, that pink blur vanished in a brilliant flash of neon pink light. When my eyes recovered, I saw the third shard floating in the air above the center of the dance floor, where the two star-crossed lovers had stood a second earlier. Artemis ran over and tried to grab the shard, but her hands passed right through. She laughed and turned back to look at me, then made a come hither motion with her index finger. I joined her on the dance floor. "For each fragment, my heir must pay a toll," I recited as I reached out and wrapped my fingers around the shard. As before, taking the shard triggered another flashback. I was Kira again, this time standing in her childhood bedroom in her mother's tiny cottage on the outskirts of London. I'd seen photographs Kira had taken of herself in this room to mail to Og back in the States during his senior year of high school, which they spent apart. Two open suitcases lay on the bed in front of me, filled with a jumble of clothing, sketchbooks, and boxes of floppy disks. Kira glanced up from her packing to look at 18-year-old Ogden Morrow, who was standing in the doorway, blocking it with his large frame. Beyond it, I could just make out a short, bald man in a ragged shirt, in the midst of yelling something in a thick Cockney accent. This had to be Kira's drunken stepfather, Graham, who was clearly enraged and only keeping his distance thanks to the cricket bat that Og was clutching with both hands and brandishing threateningly, like Shaun of the Dead. This was another moment Og had described in his autobiography, something that had occurred in April of 1990, after Kira told her family she intended to move back to the States that summer to help Og and Halliday found Gregarious Games, instead of going to university like they wanted her to. Hearing this, her abusive stepfather had become enraged and slapped her. I could still feel the dull ache of pain around her slash my left eye at that very moment. When she called Og and told him, he jumped on the first flight to London to get Kira and bring her back home. And I was experiencing Kira's memory of that rescue, or a few seconds of it anyway. Og glanced back over his shoulder, locked eyes with me slash Kira, and gave her a warm smile that let her know everything was going to be all right, that she was safe, and that he would protect her. In that instant, I also felt her intense physical reaction to Og's glance and his smile, and it gave me a sense of just how profoundly Kira had loved him. Samantha's smile still gave me the exact same sensation, a sensation best described as devastation. Then, in a blink, the flashback was over. I found myself back on the dance floor with Artemis, and when I looked down, I saw the third shard in my right hand. I turned it over to read the clue, but instead of words, I saw an image engraved there. It was an ornate shield adorned with stylized math symbols for addition, subtraction, division, and multiplication. I recognized it immediately as the coat of arms of Queen Itzalot, sovereign ruler of the magical kingdom of Itzalot on the planet Halcedonia. I felt a sudden surge of optimism, immediately followed by an overwhelming sense of dread. On one hand, this was a huge stroke of luck. I had spent a huge chunk of my childhood on Halcedonia, and my knowledge of it was encyclopedic, even by Gunter standards. But I hadn't set foot on the planet in over 10 years. And after my last visit, I'd vowed never to return. 0018. Artemis and I, along with H and Shoto, both looking shaken but eager to rejoin the quest, materialized on Halcedonia, specifically within my personal bee-free treehouse located deep within the Friendship Forest of Faraway, which was where any Halcedonian was automatically transported when they returned to the planet. Any kid in the Oasis under the age of 13 could